They're responsive.
Yes.
And they're a great audience, and I can't wait to get there.
You know what? I can't wait either. And we absolutely loved our time with the entire audience out there.
So absolutely.
We thank you. We love you. You're incredible people. And we're thrilled with the relationship that we're developing with the whole group out there. Good, good people.
Good people.
My God, this is, that's very, very cool. Once again, the pledge line is 212-209-2950. Website, givetowbai.org. And this is for you plus one friend for only $97 pledge to Prosperity Rapid Expansion 2015. Let's take you and your business to the highest level. I hope you've enjoyed the hour. This is Chris Howard once again, and we'll see you very soon. Hopefully, January 31st.
Can't wait.
All right. See you soon. Take care and make every day an extraordinary adventure.
This is Eric Anderson.
This is Rosie Perez.
You're tuned to WBAI.
What's up, ladies and gentlemen? This is LL Cool J.
This is Dave Marsh.
Hi, this is Tony Bennett.
Hi, this is Julie Cruz from New York City, and you're listening to
WBAI FM.
The soundtrack of New York City.
Non-commercial and with no additives. We're listener-supported.
I don't listen to the radio.
I don't like stuff that sucks.
You talking to me?
I love this radio station.
You talking to me?
I must say to you tonight that I never intend to become adjusted to the madness of militarism and the self-defeating effects of physical violence. No nation can win a war. It is no longer a choice between violence and nonviolence. It is either nonviolence or non-existence.
This is Dred Scott Keyes. I'll be joining Bernard White and an entire WBAI audience for a screening of Selma, a film about the African-American struggle for the right to vote in the deep apartheid South of the 1960s. The screening takes place at the Regal Union Square Cinema, 13th Street and Broadway, on Tuesday, January 27th at 7 p.m., followed by a Q&A session with the WBAI host. Tickets are $30 and can be ordered by calling 212-209-2950. That's 212-209-2950, or go to www.wbai.org.
Good morning. You're listening to WBAI Radio in New York City, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org. I'm Catherine Davis in studio with
Paulette Spencer.
And we are here with you this evening, and we are going to be sharing a few things in celebration of the life and times of Dr. Martin Luther King. And I want to, let's see if this will play for us.
My intellectual odyssey to nonviolence is a rather long thing, but the first thing was my reading of Thoreau's essay on civil disobedience when I was a college student. Later I went to theological seminary. There I came in contact with the whole stream of what is known as the social gospel, which was headed in this country by Rauschenbusch, who taught at one of the theological seminaries many years ago. And of course the emphasis there is that the Christian religion must not only be concerned about saving the individual soul, but also dealing with the social evils that corrupt the soul. So that I have been deeply influenced by the social gospel. And this caused me to become concerned about finding a method whereby social evil.
My name, it means nothing. My age, it means less. Country I come from is called the Midwest. I was brought up and taught there the laws to abide, and the land that I live in has God on its side. Oh, the history books tell it, they tell it so well. Indians fell. The Calvary's charge. The Indians died. Oh, the country was young with God on its side. Oh, the First World War, it closed at its fate. The reason for fighting I never got straight, but I learned to accept it as accept it with pride. For you don't count the dead when God's on your side. When the Second World War came to an end, we forgave the Germans and we were friends. Though they killed 6 million in the ovens they fried, the Germans now too have God on their side. But now we got weapons of the chemical dust. If fire them, we're forced to. Then fire them, we must. One push of the button and a shot the world wide. And you never ask questions when God's on your side. Oh, my name, it means nothing. My age, it means less. The country I come from is called the Midwest. I was brought up and taught there the laws to abide, and the land that I has God on its side. And the land that I live in has God on its side.
If you can accept it, you will leave those state troopers glutted with their own barbarity. If you can accept it, you will do something that will transform conditions here in Alabama. And so I'm not worried this afternoon, however dark it may be, however difficult it may be. I know that it is true, the truth forever on the scaffold. Yes, sir. Wrong forever on the throne.
Yes, sir.
That is another part of that great statement. Yet that scaffold sways the future.
Yes, sir.
And behind the dim unknown standeth God within the shadow, yes, keeping watch above his own.
Yeah.
William Cullen Bryant is right. Mm. Truth, yes, crushed to earth will rise again. The Bible is right. You shall reap what you sow. Yes. And you shall overcome.
We were marching.
to the prison of his hatred and a dream gone up in flames. To learn only at the fountains, congregations, soda shops.
Your Majesty, Your Royal Highness, Mr. President, Excellencies, ladies and gentlemen, I accept the Nobel Prize for Peace at a moment when 22 million Negroes of the United States are engaged in a creative battle to end the long night of racial injustice. I accept this award on behalf of the civil rights movement, which is moving with determination and a majestic scorn for risk and danger to establish a reign of freedom and a rule of justice. I am mindful that only yesterday in Birmingham, Alabama, our children crying out for brotherhood were answered with fire hoses, snarling dogs, and even death. I am mindful that only yesterday in Philadelphia, Mississippi, young people seeking to secure the right to vote were brutalized and murdered. I am mindful that debilitating and grinding poverty afflicts my people and chains them to the lowest rung of the economic ladder. Therefore, I must ask why this prize is awarded to a movement which is beleaguered and committed to unrelenting struggle, to a movement which has not yet won the very peace and brotherhood which is the essence of the Nobel Prize. After contemplation, I conclude that this award which I receive on behalf of that movement is a profound recognition that nonviolence is the answer to the crucial political and moral questions of our time, the need for man to overcome oppression and violence without resorting to violence and oppression. civilization and violence are antithetical concepts. Negroes of the United States, following the people of India, have demonstrated that nonviolence is not sterile passivity, but a powerful moral force which makes for social transformation. Sooner or later, all the peoples of the world will have to discover a way to live together in peace and thereby transform this pending cosmic elegy into a creative psalm of brotherhood. If this is to be achieved, man must evolve for all human conflict a method which rejects revenge, aggression, and retaliation. The foundation of such a method is love. The torturous road which has led from Montgomery, Alabama to Oslo bears witness to this truth. This is a road over which millions of Negroes are traveling to find a new sense of dignity. This same road has opened for all Americans a new era of progress and hope. It has led to a new civil rights bill, and it will, I am convinced, be widened and lengthened into a superhighway of justice as Negro and white men in increasing numbers create alliances to overcome their common problems. I accept this award today with an abiding faith in America and an audacious faith in the future of mankind. I refuse to accept despair as the final response to the ambiguities of history. I refuse to accept the idea that the isness of man's present nature makes him morally incapable of reaching up for the eternal oughtness that forever confronts him. I refuse to accept the idea that man is mere flotsam and jetsam in the river of life, unable to influence the unfolding events which surround him. I refuse to accept the view that mankind is so tragically bound to the starless midnight of racism and war that the bright daybreak of peace and brotherhood can never become a reality. I refuse to accept the cynical notion that nation after nation must spiral down a militaristic stairway into the hell of nuclear annihilation. I believe that unarmed truth and unconditional love will have the final word in reality. This is why right temporarily defeated is stronger than evil triumphant. I believe that even amid today's mortar bursts and whining bullets, that is still hope for a brighter tomorrow. I believe that wounded justice, lying prostrate on the blood-flowing streets of our nations, can be lifted from this dust of shame to reign supreme among the children of men. I have the audacity to believe that peoples everywhere can have 3 meals a day for their bodies, education and culture for their minds, and dignity, equality, and freedom for their spirits. I believe that what self-centered men have torn down, men other-centered can build up. I still believe that one day mankind will bow before the altars of God and be crowned triumphant over war and bloodshed, and nonviolent redemptive goodwill proclaim the rule of the land, and the lion and the lamb shall lie down together, and every man shall sit under his own vine and fig tree, and none shall be afraid. I still believe that we shall overcome. This faith can give us courage to face the uncertainties of the future. It will give our tired feet new strength as we continue our forward stride toward the city of freedom. When our days become dreary with low hovering clouds, and our nights become darker than a thousand midnights, we will know that we are living in the creative turmoil of a genuine civilization struggling to be born. Today I come to Oslo as a trustee, inspired and with renewed dedication to humanity. I accept this prize on behalf of all men who love peace and brotherhood. I say I come as a trustee, but in the depths of my heart, I am aware that this prize is much more than an honor to me personally. Every time I take a flight, I am always mindful of the many people who make a successful journey possible, the known pilots and the unknown ground crew. You honor the dedicated pilots of our struggle who have sat at the controls as the freedom movement soared into orbit. You honor once again Chief Luthuli of South Africa, who struggles with and for his people are still met with the most brutal expression of man's inhumanity to man. You honor the ground crew, without whose labor and sacrifice the jet flights to freedom could never have left the earth. Most of these people will never make the headlines, and their names will never appear in Who's Who. Yet when years have rolled past, and when the blazing light of truth is focused on this marvelous age in which we live, men and women will know, and children will be taught, that we have a finer land, a better people, a more noble civilization, because these humble children of God were willing to suffer for righteousness' sake. I think Alfred Nobel would know what I mean when I say I accept this award in the spirit of a curator of some precious heirloom which he holds in trust for its true owners, all those to whom truth is beauty and beauty truth, and in whose eyes the beauty of genuine brotherhood and peace is more precious than diamonds or silver or gold. Thank you.
And welcome back. You're listening to Earth at Midnight. I'm Catherine Davis here with Paulette Spencer. And we wanted to honor the life of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. And Paulette has a special presentation for you now.
Thank you, Kathy. I'm happy to actually have this opportunity. I was inspired to look at some of Dr. King's work through my memories of Robert Knight and how he would often tell me how proud he was of having a mother who was a civil rights activist in the 50s and the 60s, mm-hmm. and how exciting it was a time politically in the South, and how they were very close to or familiar with the family of Martin Luther King Jr. Mm-hmm. And so I have been reading the book Why We Can't Wait, and I thought there were two passages that really were food for thought. I mean, actually, the entire book is food for thought, but two I thought were particularly salient. The first one is from the chapter called The Summer of Our Discontent, where Dr. King very concisely describes the difference between popular revolt and revolution. He says, "A social movement that only moves people is merely a revolt. A movement that challenges both people and institutions is a revolution." And I also wanted to quote a section where it's a little bit lengthy, but he speaks about the rationale behind nonviolent protest. And that's from the chapter called The Sword That Heals. So he says, like his predecessors, the Negro was willing to risk martyrdom in order to move and stir the social conscience of his community and the nation. Instead of submitting to surreptitious cruelty in thousands of dark jail cells and on countless shadowed street corners, he would force his oppressor to commit his brutality openly in the light of day, with the rest of the world looking on. Acceptance of nonviolent direct action was a proof of a certain sophistication on the part of the Negro masses, for it showed that they dared to break with the old, ingrained concept of our society. The eye for an eye philosophy, the impulse to defend oneself when attacked, has always been held as the highest measure of American manhood. We are a nation that worships the frontier tradition, and our heroes are those who champion justice through violent retaliation against injustice. It is not simple to adopt the credo that moral force has as much strength and virtue as the capacity to return a physical blow, or that to refrain from hitting back requires more will and bravery than the automatic reflexes of defense.
Wow, that was beautiful. And we are talking about the life of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. If you have some thoughts you'd like to share, either on what you've heard, perhaps your own perspective on those times and how similar or dissimilar they are to the world right now, I would imagine that Dr. Martin Luther King would have thought by now there would be much more equality in the various systems of government and justice. And we find that things really haven't changed a whole lot. I mean, some things have and some things have not. But the number here is 212-209-2900. That's 212-209-2900. And I'm going to play for you, I think, an old familiar song.
Thank you. still rings. The bell for freedom still rings. Sorrow to me, but does it ring to know the bell of freedom still rings? The hammer for justice still pounds. The hammer for justice still pounds. Heavy is the beating sound of the hammer for justice that pounds. Stop and see. When will we feel what we've been missing? That the man in the moon must have found. 'Cause he looks upon us with a frown. To know that millions of babies still starve. Millions of babies still starve. We can't have the biggest heart if millions of babies still starve. And the innocent ones still die. The innocent ones still die. We can't value life too high if the innocent ones still die. When will the world stop and listen? When will we all stop and see? Upon us with a frown. Light of truth we won't let shine. Light of truth we won't let shine. Tell me, has the world gone blind? Light of truth we won't let shine. Life, there's still a day, and I know that we can find our way. For as long as there's life, there's still a day.
And that was Stevie Wonder, "The Bell for Freedom Still Rings." And we started the program with "Earth" by Michelle Indiacello. And we heard Odetta singing Bob Dylan with "God on Our Side." And we heard a speech from Dr. Martin Luther King. State troopers helped to organize the movement. Well, it was an excerpt from a speech. And then Janice Ian, "Black and White." We heard Dr. Martin Luther King's acceptance speech for when he won the Nobel Peace Prize. And we heard the Rascals, "People Got to Be Free." And, of course, we just heard "Bell for Freedom." And you heard a bit of reading by Paulette Spencer of the book with "Why We Can't Wait" by Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. So I thought that was a nice presentation to honor a great hero, American hero, I believe, and, well, global hero, really, when you think about it. And it's interesting, you know, when I think about him, because he was so young when he was assassinated.
39.
Yeah. And I'm like, wow, that's really young. And when you think of all that he managed to accomplish up until that point, and then still the impact that it has had on the world, it's quite remarkable that a single human being could have done so much. But when you look at it also, you see that he was answering his call. You know, the world was calling to him, and I was listening to a lot of material this afternoon, and he, in one of his talks, he spoke of how, you know, the people in Mississippi were really fed up with the whole system there. And then there was the Revolutionary Act of Rosa Parks, when she refused to move to the back of the bus. And they created an improvement association, and then he was asked to head it. And then he accepted. And then, you know, it sort of carried him in a way. He just sort of jumped into the call of the time. He was there in the right place at the right time, and he had the courage to walk that path.
Absolutely. He had the courage, the drive, the perseverance,
and the willingness to make that sacrifice, because when you listen to his I Have a Dream speech, you recognize that he knew what was coming. Not I Have a Dream, Mountaintop speech, excuse me. And also, at various points throughout his life, he was threatened. His family was threatened over and over again. And yet he kept going. He kept going. He kept going until he was stopped by bullets. It's really rather remarkable that he had the courage to do that, and with all the controversy and the violence around him, that he was able to hold firm that nonviolence, that position of nonviolence. And I think that it's advice that we could use today. It's advice that we can still live by, to face our struggles with a peaceful countenance. You know, I think that's a beautiful inspiration. The number here is 212-209-2900. Perhaps you have some thoughts about this, about Dr. King, about answering the call of your life experience. You know, we all get called into a life that we didn't quite expect, at least I think so. And certainly I didn't know where my life would take me, and I don't know yet where I'm going, but I'm trying to have as much fun as I can along the way, and to stay in that place of balance, that place of spirit, that place of I guess integrity would be the word. And so I think that's something that we are all trying and endeavoring to do. I believe we do have a phone call coming in. I'm going to say hello. You're on the air.
How are you?
I'm good, thank you. How are you?
Good. Kathy, hey.
Hi.
Kathy.
Yes.
When I hear on your last point about being nonviolent in response to the violence all around King, I just heard a segment just 10 seconds ago on Fox, Megyn Kelly. They're so violent, and Dana Perino against Barack Obama with their snide comments, and they don't mention the oil spill. They're bought off by the corporations. They're so violent. I couldn't hope for a greater violence to befall them. Okay, Kathy, that's where I stand with on nonviolence.
Okay, well, thank you. That's unfortunate, but, you know, it's an honest response, so what can I say? It is true that violence is more than the physical violence. Violence is also done in word and deed. You know, people speak violently and call for violence.
There's also structural violence.
Yeah. So there's much violence in the world that we are contending with. I don't think that calling for more violence is the answer. I'm not saying that I do know the answer. I don't believe that that is the answer. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi, good evening. This is Michael Grant.
Yes.
A friend of Paulette Spencer.
Hello, Michael.
Hi, how are you?
I am okay. How you doing?
We're good, thank you.
You know, in a way, I'm almost speechless, but, you know, as you know, Robert and I, our paths over the years have converged. We know similar people. Robert and I, over the years, have shared anecdotal stories about that period. While I didn't know Martin Luther King personally, you know, I knew some of the lieutenants around him, one of whom became a personal friend of mine.
Wow.
You know, Reverend Wyatt Walker was one of my living heroes. You know, so was Kwame Ture.
That's extraordinary. What was that like, knowing him?
All I can say, it enriched my life. That's the best way I can put it.
Beautiful. Thank you.
So, yes, I hope to speak to you again soon.
You will.
Okay.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye now.
Thank you.
And we have another caller. Hello, you're on the air.
Yes, good morning. How are you, ma'am?
I'm good, thank you. How are you?
Okay. I just wanted to tell you that it really saddens me about what's going on in this world with human beings. I went to see Selma last night, and it was so disturbing to me to see how human beings can treat other human beings so cruelly, regardless of any race, creed, and color. We're all human beings. We're all children of God. And, you know, it's just unbelievable to see and to witness such human cruelty towards other human beings. And I just can't believe how people can be like that. And especially after so many years that Dr. King has passed away, it doesn't seem that that people have changed at all. It seems that, as a matter of fact, it seems that people have gotten worse. It seems that people have gotten more into technology with their smartphones and their computers and everything else that has nothing to do with human contact. And we say that we're an advanced race and we're so advanced, but yet we're so backwards in human relations. We're not communicating with each other in this world. And as you can see, all these terrible police killings all over the country, and how the police never get prosecuted. They always walk free from these killings. There's a terrible injustice in this country, and there really needs to be some type of resolution to it. And Dr. King preached nonviolence. And it would be wonderful if that could be the solution, but it doesn't seem that the nonviolence system seems to work. It's only when there's a catastrophe, an atrocity, that things happen after that. And I wish that we could all get along, everyone, and put down the smartphones and the computers and start communicating with each other, talking to each other, hugging each other, kissing each other, making human contact, and realize that every person that you see is yourself. We're all the same, with no difference. I mean, separation is an illusion, and we're all brothers and sisters. We're children of God, and I think that Martin Luther King was talking to everyone when he was, you know, preaching, that it was for everyone, not just for, you know, African Americans. It was for everybody to know that we're all one, and that's what I have to say.
Thank you. I agree. I agree with so much of what you said. Thank you for your call.
You're welcome.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we do want to find a way, a nonviolent way, of coming together. But communicating is a good first step. Hello, you're on the air? First
yes,
caller?
Hello.
Yes, hi.
Hi, my name is Rashid.
Hello, Rashid.
I first of all, I want to thank you for what I've heard so far. I was driving out here from school. I teach a course at SUNY Old Westbury on the sociology of culture and the sociology of violence is another course I teach. And as I was listening to you talk about violence earlier, I could not help but think about state violence. And what made it come across my mind is, I don't know how many of your listeners might be aware of this. Perhaps you've heard of the book by William Pepper called An Act of State.
Yes, I'm familiar with it.
If your listeners aren't, if any of them might be interested, the Act of State talks about a 30-year investigation into the assassination of Dr. King on behalf of James Earl Ray, who Mr. Pepper asserts was innocent of that assassination. And in the civil suit on behalf of the King family and Mr. Ray, there was a 3-hour return of the jury finding for the King family that implicated the federal government in the King assassination. It implicated the FBI. It implicated the CIA. There were army officers with cameras on a nearby rooftop outside the Lorraine Motel. There were two snipers triangulating on Dr. King's position on that balcony. There came proof into the civil court with regard to the connection and the collusion between military and government agencies with organized crime and criminal elements. You know, I mean, it was really, really quite astounding. You never hear anything about it. I hope people will go ahead and get that book and read about it. But it's a part of my curriculum so that people can begin to understand what state violence looks like. It's not just all the stuff people see on the news. It's the news that people don't see.
Yeah, and the news is constructed in such a way that we don't see it. What, you know, I am familiar with what you're speaking of, and I think the same thing is true of the Kennedy assassinations.
Indeed so.
And I also think the same thing is true of the killings that are happening in our streets from, you know, police violence and hostility. And there's two things that ways that I respond to that. One is, yes, it is true that there is a massive or a very powerful state force behind the violence we see, not just here in the world, in New York, but in the world. It's not just the black community. It's happening to the Palestinian in the Middle East. It's happening, you know, with this group ISIS. I don't know if I really believe it's what they're telling us it is. So I think that there's this huge manipulation of some aspect of the state that is maintaining a system of violence and degradation within the world. And I believe that that's true. But the other side of that is that we are not really getting the message at how much people do want peace and are willing to work for peace and are not hating each other, that a lot of what we see, the destructive behavior we see, is really not largely flowing from the population. It's flowing from the state. So if we can find a way to make that, have that understanding, and as the first caller said, begin to look at each other with a deal, you know, a sense of brotherhood and with peace, and if it could be clear to more people what's happening, then perhaps there's a chance that it can be changed.
Of course, of course. So the populations never want to send their sons and daughters into, you know, into harm's way. It's the political, and these people are very cynical, but we know by now that most of them, if not all, are bought and paid for by corporate interests at this point.
Mm-hmm.
Transnational corporations are owned by somebody. They have shareholders, and they have people, you know, who the 1% everybody keeps hearing about and talking about, really, it doesn't take that much to be a part of the 1%. If you've got an income of about 600,000, not an income, but a wealth, a net worth of 600,000 or more, that's all it takes to be a part of the 1%. But the 1/1000th of the 1%, this is the transnational, global, superclass. These people are concentrated in only about a dozen countries. living in about six countries, educated in the same universities, marrying endogamously. So, you know, it's a small set of people, only about 6,000 to 7,000 people globally that we're talking about, and it's a feudal system in another form.
It really is, but I think part of the reason it works is because people have been so programmed and so brainwashed into supporting and sustaining that system.
Absolutely.
So I think that what you're doing, the education is really important so that people can begin to stop supporting it. You know, we need to, as a population, as a humanity, we have to start participating in that system. It will fall if we stop participating in it economically. So I want to thank you for your call. We have someone standing by. Did you want to say? Okay, thank you very much. Call again.
Thank you.
Take care now. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay, we have another call standing by. And hello, you're on the air.
Hi, Kathy. I have laryngitis. This is Spider Blue. Hi.
Oh, hi, Spider. How are you?
I'm okay. Listen, a couple things. He's the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Is that too difficult for people to say? Janis Joplin, she checked into the Lorraine, and she checked right out. After he was assassinated, she checked right out.
Okay.
Hey, Qigong Master. You know what I saw for the third time at the ballet place at Lincoln Center? Shenyang?
Uh-huh.
Shenyang?
That's the cultural program from
China. Threw them out.
Yeah. I think it's not from mainland China.
It was from some part of China.
Yeah. Well, I know because I interviewed a lot of the folks who from the Falun Gong when there was a lot of trouble with the Falun Gong.
You know I love Falun Gong. You know me. Yep.
Yeah, and so there has a history of very intense political suppression since Tiananmen Square.
Yeah.
And so what happened is that, you know, the folks who put together this cultural group are really people who are working towards their liberation from the perspective of not being communist.
Right, well,
because of that, they've had a lot of opposition both in China and here in the United States.
Well, yeah.
And in fact, when they were on, I had interviewed them when Heart of Mine was on Thursday nights at 10 o'clock. Somebody actually came and tried to attack them there.
Oh.
And so we had to, the doorman had to escort them out of the back of the door because they were talking about this event, and the person who was attacking them was staunchly communist. And so in the beginning, there was a lot of controversy in the beginning, though now they seem to be quite mainstreamed.
No, but at 120 Wall, that was?
Yeah, it happened at 120 Wall.
Oh,
it used to be, it was a while ago. It was before, you know, they stopped people at the door and you could just walk up. So it was ages ago. All right, well, I got to run. Thank you so much for calling, Spider.
Okay.
Take it easy.
Stay strong, my sister.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Spider was an engineer at WBAI many years ago. The number here is 212-209-2900, and actually one of the best. 212-209-2900. If you have any thoughts, you want to give us a call, please do join us. And we're talking about finding peace through nonviolence. And I think education and information is a big part of it. People are dropping out of the system, I think. People are dropping out of the corporate system. I think it's become so extreme that folks are looking for another way. Even people who are doing well are looking for another way to heal the world. I from what I can discern, even though people are distracted by their technology and walking around crossing streets while texting on a phone, my sense is that people really do want the world to be better.
I agree. And as we talk about change, I'm thinking about one of the lines that I read about a movement that changes both people and institutions is a revolution.
Mm-hmm.
And my sense is that perhaps for many of these revolutions, you actually have to be perhaps placed in an institution to work from the inside out.
Maybe.
Sometimes
I think that may be true. I was doing some reading over the weekend, and from a different source, more of a spiritual source, I suppose you would say, what I was reading was that revolution is not the answer, it's evolution, because revolution is just turning in circles.
True.
You know, and I think from the perspective of you know, what was happening in the 50s and the 60s, and from the perspective of wanting to make change, I can understand that drive towards a revolution, revolt, you know, turning over a new leaf, coming to a new leadership. But what I've seen historically is too often the ones, once they gain power, start doing the same bad behavior, in a sense. From the perspective of, say, the revolution in China, you know, there were a revolution where it was you know, take down the the aristocracy, take down the dynasties and bring the power of the people, and that happened. The same thing happened in Russia, but then those new leaders went on to kill masses of people. And, you know, so in order to create that environment, that pristine environment, so there's something missing there. When you are fighting against an oppressor, you come into power, and as a consequence, you have a need to kill more people. So there's like a revolving happening there.
I see your point.
Mm-hmm. But
I guess I've been influenced by recent documentary that I watched on PBS on the life of Judge Thurgood Marshall,
mm-hmm.
and his whole development, and how this small team of lawyers fought their way into the best colleges and used the law that as it was developed against the system itself.
Mm-hmm.
And they did that on several fronts and were able to actually break down quite a few barriers by basically saying, if this is the word of the law of the land, and you're claiming this has to apply to everyone, then you have to literally make sure that it's enacted across the country. And they force them to enact their own laws.
Okay. So is that revolution or evolution?
It may be a bit of both.
Yeah, maybe so. All right, we have a caller joining us. Hello, you're on the air.
Hello?
Yes,
yeah,
you're on the air. Please.
I just want to add one minor correction to your statement.
Okay.
And, you know, you named, as the president did, first I'll say the president named a bunch of specific causes that certain groups had, but ironically enough, he never dealt specifically with the problem of the Black American or the American Negro. And he does this quite constantly. And as far as your comment,
which president are you speaking of?
Obama.
Oh, I didn't.
Last night's speech, he named everybody but Black Americans.
Okay.
Anyway, let me get on to what I was going to.
Yeah, I'm just saying that I didn't mention Obama,
I'm mentioning this to try and draw a correlation between what you said about this so-called imaginary coalition between the peoples of the world. As sympathetic as we, as Black Americans, can be for other countries, once they get here, they still have the privilege to treat us like, quote-unquote, the N-word. In this city, for example, they have push carts, they have food stands, Blacks don't have anything. Now, when you think about it, if you look at the old movies, who were the cooks? Who were the waitresses? Who were the servants? who are they now? Are there any black Americans doing it? And this is done by design. And I'm tired of the left pretending that we're all equal as far as having problems. That doesn't mean I can't empathize with the problems of the third world. The American Negro is not a minority. And I hate the use of that word. Don't lump me together with people that come across the borders illegally. I have a long history of ancestors who died despite the fact that they didn't have rights. So I think it's blasphemous for you and anyone else to say that my problems are the same as someone in Palestine or in Israel or wherever. And I know this sounds trivial, but the fact is I think that...
Sounds interesting. I wouldn't trivialize what you're saying because I think you're speaking from a deep sense of what your experience and what you feel. So I respect that. I don't necessarily feel that way, but I respect you feel that way and your right to feel that way. And I'm glad you have a chance to give that point.
And I thank you for allowing me the opportunity. Yeah. And I don't mean to cause any chaos, but the fact is, stop lying to the public. We're not all in the same situation. Arabs are coming into our community, people from the Caribbean, and Israel, everywhere else, and taking the money out and sending it to other countries. That's why Harlem and Bed-Stuy are in such a moral decay. Thank you.
Thank you. I disagree. I think that that's a truth, but it's not the whole story. We have another caller. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi.
Please turn off your radio.
Okay, it's on. Mm-hmm. Hi, Catherine.
Hi.
I'm calling just to echo something that you said about the evolution rather than revolution, because I'm spiritualist, and I know I've been trying to, sort of raise my myself as far as in the spiritual way and understand that, you know, we have animal tendencies. I don't think we're animals, but I think that since we've come from there, from that kingdom into the kingdom that we are now, that we still have those tendencies. And in order for us to get out of those tendencies, it's going to take time, the time of evolution, to help to get rid of those types of tendencies that we have, because we are constantly raising up as humans, and with our evolution, we will start to get out of that animalness and into more of an intuitiveness. And so the direction that we're headed in as far as that intuitiveness, but it's like the hands of a clock. We're not going to be able to see it. It's just going to be that way in the future. And we have to understand that, like sometimes as the Buddhists say, we are where we are because we have put ourselves there. And we will be where we will be at the time that we don't have those kind of tendencies anymore because we put ourselves there due to evolution. So that's really what I have to say about it.
Okay, thank you. It's interesting your perspective. It's interesting your perspective. I actually don't think that animals are as bad as humans. I think it's the other way around. I actually think animals are more evolved. I mean, you know, an animal will eat you when it's hungry, but otherwise it pretty much will leave you alone. And so it's only human beings, I think, that are premeditated in through thought and how they can acquire, accumulate, and deprive. So I think that's a human quality that animals don't have. And if we were more like animals, we might actually be more civilized.
Yeah, I agree with that. The other thing I have to say about that is that I believe that as humans, we are the ones that are able to understand more that there is something outside of ourselves, which I don't think animals have that ability.
No.
So therefore, that's why we've been able to, as we see, been able to create all the stuff that we have been able to create, whereas animals, of course, cannot do that.
Right.
To me, that makes it quite apparent that we are a higher form.
And we need to evolve. Mm-hmm. I have a few more calls trying to come in before the end of the show. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Let's see. Hello, you're on the air. Hello?
Hello, dear.
Yes, hi.
Thank you for taking my call. and I hope I'm not being redundant.
Is your radio off?
Yes, it is now.
Okay, thanks.
Okay?
Uh-huh.
Okay. Just to basically tag on to what the gentleman said previous to the gentleman who just spoke, you know, I think that we have to consider this idea.
All right, can you hold on?
You know, many of us have read or have heard of Willie Lynch. And I think the Willie Lynch syndrome or practice has been sort of tweeted for modern day living. When we look at it, here in America, people come from all over. South America, Europe, Russia, Israel, and they're told before coming not to associate it with African Americans because they're really not very good people. Now, once getting here, since people do not know their history of the people of the world and do not know how they have been basically one human race, how they have branched off in different parts of the world and have acquired because of nature and living conditions various attributes, which glance of the eyes, pointing of the nose, growing of the hair, or broadening of the nostrils, etc., etc.
And what is it that you're trying to say? The point.
So what I'm saying is, when people are brought here, the Willie Lynch tweeted version is basically we're being pitted against one another. For example, out here where I am living on Long Island, there's a great influx of people from Latin America. Now, the taxes that are gathered go towards 70% or more of your school bill, okay? The taxes, that is, of homeowners. So since the new arrivals do not own homes but rent, the burden of education falls on the taxpayer. When you have a person who is retired or a fixed income, then there's a resentment for those who are coming in. The brother had mentioned about the jobs of waiters and waitresses.
I know. Well, see, if I may, because yes. I'm getting short on time.
Okay.
I do understand what you're saying. I understood what the brother was saying. But the point that I'm trying to make is that we have to check ourselves at some point and recognize that we are one human family. Now, granted, everyone has been subject to the same programming, the same pitting one against each other, the same prejudices. There are prejudices in everyone. There are resentments in everyone, usually based on the system of economics that's designed to pit us against each other. And I think that it's important for us to begin to challenge those frame of references. Now, as far as the Latin people coming in and not owning homes, you know what? Their children are important as anyone else's children, and they deserve to be educated as much as anyone else's child. What and the same thing is, I said their children deserve to be educated as much as any child.
What you said is 100% true, but consider this fact. We may have humanity in our hearts, but we don't spend humanity on food or for food.
Actually, we do. And I think it's the attitude of not being willing to really recognize the divinity, the humanity of each other is the core problem. The problem is economics is only the symptom of us not understanding that we are human and we're responsible for ourselves and we're responsible for each other. We have to come to that recognition, and that's the only thing that's going to change it. If we don't come to that recognition, we will forever be in this cycle of...
We are aware of the recognition, but the point is that 1% that controls, or 1/100th, I forgot how the gentleman phrased it, 1,000th of 1% that control the riches of the land, they are the people that, in essence...
No, I disagree. You know, what they control are the minds of the people that control the money. Because the money passes through our hands. It's just that we're not conscious.
Passes through our hands,
and we're not conscious, and we're not working together, and we're pitted against each other, and we're allowing ourselves to be pitted against each other. And so I think the 1% is smart, and I think the 1% is responsible for the programming and the brainwashing, and is responsible for many things. But we have to start looking at the part that we play and what we can do about it. Because
to
sit around and point a finger at the 1%,
what can we do besides acknowledging the fact that we are all one?
Well, we can allow our taxes to pay for the education of a child that comes from another country, is what we can do without complaining, understanding that that child deserves to be fed, housed, and educated.
Right, at the cost of your child.
Not at the cost of anyone's child.
What I'm saying is...
No, I'm sorry. I have to go. Yes. Just about out of time. I have another call standing by, though. Please call back. You know, it's a good conversation. It's just that we've been at it for a while.
I don't want to give the impression that I'm saying, you know, that we are against one group or against another group.
I don't have that impression at all.
Okay, beautiful.
I really don't.
Listen, I thank you for
It's just a dialogue, you know?
Yeah, and you've got others...
Yeah, thank you.
Okie dokie, bye-bye.
Bye. You know, you get inspired by what someone says, and it may not have a relationship to what they said, but it's what comes up for you. Hello, you're on the air? Are you there?
There.
Oh, there you
are.
Can
you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you now.
Yeah, I thank you so much for your chat there, because I think you put put forth a very important challenge. I think, you know, look, so much of this has, and of course this goes beyond before NAFTA, but a lot of the conditions of why people from Latin America coming over here, do you think people from Latin America want to come over here, leave their homes, and come to a land where they're seen as people from, you know, Alpha Centauri, and you know, extraterrestrials, you know, an illegal alien, that they come here of their free volition to be pitted and wedged in between African-American and Americans of European descent? This is a complicated problem, and to have people call up, you know, and then want to create the scenario whereby they want to blame people who are coming here, trying to do the best they can with what they have. A lot of these people don't necessarily have the time to make themselves aware of the history of the African American. Now, that's sad, but are we going to blame them, or are we going to blame the education system, which doesn't teach anybody here anything? Even if the elite white people aren't taught the history that, you know, Howard Zinn teaches. So we have to look at this more holistically. We're going to go out in the streets and beat the hell out of each other, and the people that are going to win at the end are going to be the most mercenary and the sickest of all.
Well, see, that is the point, you know, and I think that's part of what we need to recognize, that this is the point of this whole system, is so that, because this is where race actually came from. In the United States, in the early forming of this country, there were black slaves, there were Irish slaves, there were Scottish slaves, there were many slaves, there were many indentured servants. And what happened is that the people began to unite and fight together for their liberation. And then there was this consciousness of race that began to be embedded into people's minds.
And so
racism, you know, I'm not saying that it started here. It started, you know, excuse me, I don't know actually where it started, but it probably started in Europe 200,000 years ago. I don't know exactly when, but it wasn't always the consciousness of humanity. And so I think we have to begin to really, really expand our consciousness beyond these ideas of my pain is more than your pain, and I was here first and you came last, and I was the one who was a slave and you weren't a slave.
Right.
I mean, everybody has their suffering, and I don't think we need to take a measuring tape and see who suffered more, because to the individual, suffering is suffering is suffering. And
can I say one more thing?
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think even if there were, I mean, how can you quantify suffering in historical, like, you know, you can't measure something like that. And even if you could, even if we could, to what holy end would that bring us anyway? Because then we say, well, on our scale, we have suffered more than these people, so therefore what? Where does that take us in any direction?
Well, what it ends up becoming is a justification for us to, instead of saying, I have suffered, therefore I can't let you suffer, the equation becomes, I've suffered, so now it's your turn to suffer.
Right.
And so we need to change that equation so that we can say, you know what, yeah, black people built this country, black people suffered to make this place strong, and I'm standing for the fact that this needs to stop and not another human being needs to go through that. So, you know, it depends on the stand that we take and what it means to us. And I don't find it, you know, so everybody has their own way and their own path and their own understanding. This is my way. So I thank you for your call. We have to make room. The next show will be coming in. Thank you very much. Bye-bye. Okay, we have one more call. I'm going to take this call, but you're going to have to be lightning fast. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi, Kathy. How you doing?
Good, thank you.
I just had it low on my radio. I had never heard that speech from Dr. King, where he had received an award. Was that a Nobel Prize?
He received a Nobel Peace Prize, yes.
Well, I was truly moved. I mean, which rarely happens with me. I'm just not a mushy kind of guy, but I mean, my eyes welled up. His beauty, his honesty, his gentleness, it's just everything. I just thought was spectacular.
Yeah, it was a beautiful and revolutionary speech when you think about the timing of it. You know, and he's speaking about the oppression in South Africa, and he's speaking about all these things and what it really represents. You know, could we find anyone in this day and age who would come up into a public place and make a statement like that? I don't think
so. Exactly. I can't believe you said it. You took the words out of my mouth. That was the point of the call. It's like, where is, now he's an impossible act to follow. I'm not saying that we need the next Dr. King, but I really feel like our representation is sorely lacking. I mean, it's embarrassingly, it's just terrible. And I don't understand how, I mean, do you have any thought, like, how do we get somebody that can be representative?
I think we're living in an age when each human being has to take that responsibility on. And so you may not be able to be on a stage like King, but maybe there'll be experience on the job where you have a chance to stand up. Maybe there'll be experience in the street where you'll have a chance to speak up. You know, like when I look at, you know, the violence with the police, you know, I'm more looking at the cops who are standing around staring more than the crazy one who's doing the beating up. Because I'm like, where's your conscience? And I think that's the only way. It's like we have to each individually stand up and be accountable for ourselves and for what happens in our environment.
I think that's very insightful and wise, and I agree with you on that.
Yeah.
I think Dr. King articulated that to an extent where he referenced the pilots. We all know who the pilots are.
Yeah.
We don't know who the ground crew are, and the ground crew are so crucially, they're as important as a pilot.
It's right. But, I mean, it's like even the whole civil rights movement was started on one person saying, I've had enough.
Right.
And so imagine if 100,000 people say, I've had enough.
But do you
That's
think
what it's going to take.
My concern is, and I'd like your opinion, do you think it's counterproductive to have bad... You're saying that, okay, we all individually have to do it in our own ways at the right times, and I agree with you. But don't you think that it's detrimental, it's seriously counterproductive if our spokespeople are... And I'm not going to name names, but it's just, you know, the usual suspects, the ones we always know that are out there.
Well, I think we can assume.
I think they're doing justice to us.
I don't think that the spokes model works anymore. You know, there are no people out there who can speak for humanity anymore. Humanity has to stand up and speak for humanity. I don't think there are leaders capable of doing it. And so the more we sit
Why
around...
Why is that?
Because the system is so corrupt at this point. It's at a maximum state of corruption, and to even get into that system, to get a position, to be in a political position, to be in a corporate position, you would have had to have sold out eons ago. So those people are not reachable by conscience. They're only reachable by pocketbook.
Mm-hmm.
So it calls for people with conscience to be conscious of what we're doing with our money, with our energy, with our time, and be willing to say, I'm not going to work for a corporation that's killing people.
I think that's right on target.
You know, that's the only way, is that humanity has to stand up and
listen,
stop waiting for a savior.
You're probably embarrassed at this request, but sometime, maybe not tonight, although I will listen intently and hope that you will accommodate me. I'd love to hear about your background. A lot of us are not long-term listeners I've listened to you a number of times, but I'd be very interested in knowing who you are, you know, where you come from, what your experience has been, you know what
okay,
I mean?
Okay, well,
I mean, go back to when you were kids. I'd love to know a little bit more about you.
All right, I'll think about that.
All right,
and but I have to go now. It's time for Hour of the Wolf. Thank you.
The prayer of the children abandoning in the shadow of an unknown room. Empty eyes with no more tears to cry, turning heavenward toward the light. Cry, Jesus, help me to see the morning light of one more day. But if I should die before I pray my soul take. Can you feel the hearts of the children aching for home, for something of their very own? Reaching hands with nothing to hold on to, but hope for a better. A better day. Crying, Jesus, help me to feel the love again in my own land. But if unknown roads lead away from home, give me loving arms away from home. Gospel full of hate.
Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a Wednesday night, Thursday morning program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, imagination, and enchantment. My name is Jim Freund. This morning, a classic but modern radio drama, Eyes Bootstraps, based on a short story by Robert Heinlein, starring. I'm Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf.
The fascinating thing about the new fantasy film Paddington is how it ushers the marmalade sandwich into the pantheon of cinematic signifiers. Marmalade is, of course, the foodstuff of choice of Paddington, a young CG animated bear voiced by Ben Whishaw. And like the Ring of Power or lightsaber, it defines the character, who was born in the jungles of Peru and represents his assimilation into British civilization. And for American audiences, this may make sense. In addition to the bear's fusty, floppy hat, his very proper manners, and the tag on his coat that reads, "Please look after this bear," reminiscent of the children who were relocated in World War II during the London bombings, the marmalade sandwich may seem the most British of consumables. But this is actually quite deceptive, since marmalade owes more of its commercial origin to Scotland than to Britain proper. In fact, it was the Scottish family of Keeler who established the first marmalade plant in 1797, and they were also responsible for the first commercially produced Dundee cake, named, of course, after the Scottish city, whose economy presently is more dependent on the biomedical field, and whose football club, Dundee FC, is well-regarded among the Scottish. Oh, hell, you just want me to talk about Peter Capaldi, don't you? Yes, the actor who now plays the 12th Doctor is in Paddington as one of the live-action performers playing against the animated bear. No, it's not a lead role, but as the cantankerous Mr. Curry, neighbor to the family who eventually wind up the de facto adoptive family of the earnest but accident-prone Paddington, it is a prominent role, to the point where he briefly joins forces with the amoral taxidermist played by Nicole Kidman, who wants nothing more than to see the bear stuffed and mounted in her museum. Not surprisingly, particularly if you know Capaldi as much from his work as the scarily imposing and foul-mouthed political fixer Malcolm Tucker in the TV series The Thick of It and the film In the Loop, the actor handles his role with aplomb and is one of the pleasant features in a film that does have a number of them. Only those fans whose interest in Paddington hinges solely on Capaldi's participation will be disappointed. Thing is, the operating principle of Paddington as a whole is not to lean too heavily on any one element or another. The film was directed and co-written by Paul King, who counts among his other credits The Mighty Boosh, a comedy TV series that regularly used a narrative line to draw together a number of tonally diverse, sketch-like bits. The same aesthetic is at work here, toned down to family-friendly proportions. Basically, if you don't like the Paddington you're presently watching, just wait. Another one will be around in a few seconds. A little slapstick comedy cadged from the chapters of the Paddington books here, some Wes Anderson posturing there, even a bit of Buster Keaton attitude. At a couple of points, a dollhouse in an attic spontaneously opens to take care of some exposition. It all gets thrown into the mix. Not all of it works. An opening sequence showing Paddington's life in Peru with his aunt and uncle feels like a textbook example of how insubstantial CG animation can be. A sequence that references Mission Impossible by quoting the visuals of the film franchise and the music of the original series feels a little too forced, and the whole villainous taxidermist bit, as entertaining as Kidman is in the role, feels kind of stock and unnecessary. This is what a family film may call for these days, this kind of jeopardy, although it never gets scary enough to unsettle the kids. One doesn't always have to answer the call, though. All told, Paddington pops along pleasantly enough. There's enough funny stuff and some nicely done imagery along the way, and even the flubs aren't especially painful. Not one for the ages, but like the humble marmalade sandwich, it'll sustain you. I'm Dan Persons. Remember, we are archiving these reviews over at my Mighty Movie Podcast website, so check out what you missed by going to mightymoviepodcast.com.
Indeed. And good morning again. This is Hour of the Wolf. My name's Jim Freund. And last week, Dan, who was also here live, reviewed a new movie called Predestination, which I have not yet seen, but it is based on the Robert Heinlein story, All You Zombies. I can well understand why they wouldn't maintain that title, All You Zombies, because then all these people are going to flock to the theater to see a zombie movie and instead get a time travel piece, one that, if it resembles the aforementioned Doctor Who, is because I suspect that Stephen Moffat is somewhat influenced, as so many people are, by the writings of Heinlein. And the way that Heinlein pulls together time travel and how things fit together, something that Moffat does so incredibly well in episodes of Doctor Who that he's written, like Blink, and the final episode of what they call Season 5, which is a two-parter, but especially the second part, the time-hopping stuff, is absolutely frantic and wonderful. And you're going to hear some of some of the earlier stuff from the 1940s, a story from 1940, I'll look it up, by his bootstraps. But first, I wanted to talk about that a little bit more and a couple of notes. Here's a note. I watched on TV, on Amazon Video Flowing,